Okay, so we go to the post-transcriptional regulation still. We are in the third part of the post-transcriptional regulation. And we try to exit from nucleus, finally. And we discuss quality control, methylation, stability, and a little bit of RNA interference that is actually... It's actually the start of the story about microRNA that we will develop in the last lesson. So, during the last lesson, we discussed capping, splicing, poly A, and the binding of RNA binding proteins. Especially, we spend a lot of time about splicing and alternative splicing, and we also told something about editing. And so the question is, now the RNA particle is ready for translation or for its function, whatever. And the story is that there are still some other stories going on. And the first one is the other post-transcriptional modification that can happen to our RNA. And probably the primary one is this N6 methyl adenosine. That at least is the, apparently is the most frequent. And at least is the most studied today. So there are many papers on this problem. Actually, it's not the only one, because we see many other modifications in RNA. This one, that is N1 methyl adenosine, so the methyl is deposited on the atom N1 of the adenine, or this that you know, 5 methyl cytosine. Actually, this is the modification of DNA, typical of DNA, of course, as you know, but sometimes we can find it also in RNA. And another modification is the pseudouridine, that is quite abundant, actually, in mature RNAs, especially in ribosomal RNA and transfer RNA. But also we can find more rarely, but it is possible to find it in messenger RNA as well. And finally, this one, that is the 2O methyl nucleosides, a methylation of 2' prime of ribose. This is also quite frequent, especially at the in the first nucleotide of the transcript. Anyway, we will discuss only the first one, the N6. And the N6 actually is deposited. So this is the modification. This is adenine, and you see that the methyl and adenine here. This is adenine 6, the nitrogen atom 6. So there are many enzymes which can carry out this kind of modification. They are called methyl 3, methyl 14, WT8, and KIA1429. All these are eukaryotic enzymes, of course, and are found in mammals and in humans as well. And they are expressed on a cell-specific basis, okay? So cell type dependent. And then we have readers. I mean, we have proteins which can bind to this kind of modification on RNA, and they are called YTH or HNRNP, specific classes, as you can see here. HNRNP A2B1, that is one of the classes A of HR, heterogeneous nuclear ribonuclear proteins, or this NHRNPC. Okay, that's another member. Of course, the knowledge of this methyl RNA has arisen only recently, And people usually make a kind of immunoprecipitation using antibody that recognizes this modification, and they sequence the RNA around. So making this kind of experiments, they could align all the motifs that are around the methylation, and what emerged was a kind of consensus. You can see here, that is the two nucleotides before and two nucleotides after the adenine, which gets methylated. And this RR means, of course, purine. And this C is C, and this H is non-G, as you remember. Okay. So it's a kind of poor consensus, and there is no specific reason to have any kind of more specific element, of course. Then we have also enzymes which can cancel, can erase the modification, and this ALK-B-H5 and FTO are the two enzymes that are present in human. Okay, so actually this is a kind of dynamic modification in which you can have either methylation or demethylation quite easily, okay, the site. Okay, the writer and erasers and reader proteins are primarily localized in nuclear spicules. So they are, apparently they make part of this kind of RNA factories that we described in the very early lessons, in which probably most of the enzymes that take care of the RNA metabolism are present. Okay, what is the effect of methylation on disposition of RNA? Okay, we can have kind of direct and indirect effects, okay? Indirect effects are linked to the fact that, of course, the methyl group at the N6 position of methyl adenine does not change Watson Crick specificity, okay? So the A will always pair with T or U, okay? But the problem is that it weakens the duplex RNA by around 1.4 kilocalories per mole. So it means that when you have a specific methylation, for example, think about a hairpin loop. This object here is a hairpin loop in RNA. Okay, so you have a certain stability, and if you methylate the adenine over there, you will decrease the stability of the hairpin. Okay, so for example, if you have a protein which can bind to this sequence here, for example, HNRMPC, okay, it won't bind because the sequence is engaged in duplex, okay, but when you have methylation, this will probably bind the protein. So it's a kind of indirect regulation of binding of some proteins, okay? This is the first effect. The second one is that you have a direct effect because when you have a methylation in the RNA, you have, as you have seen, you have binding, specific binding of proteins. And for example, here you see this HNRNPA2B1, which is a splicing factor. So you have a modification there. You will recruit this protein, and this protein will direct splicing of the exon in this position. Okay? So increase splicing. This in the nucleus, but actually this modification is written on the RNA and will be stable after the RNA is brought to the cytoplasm. Okay, so you have also cytoplasmatic effect here. And for example, you have in the cytoplasm you have these two proteins, YTHDF1 and YGADF2. That apparently they have opposite effect on RNA that is methylated. When you have a YTHDF1, okay, apparently it interacts with EIF3, and that you probably you remember that EIF means elongation factor. Means eukaryotic initiation factor for translation. Okay. So, and you have this recruitment, the translation, this is the small subunit of ribosome, will increase the translation rate, okay? On the other side, on the right, okay, when you have modification here, this is methylation, YTHDF2 can bind here, and as you can see, this protein interacts with another protein, which is called CNOT1, which actually interacts with an exonuclease. So in this case, the methylation will actually increase the adenylation, okay, of the RNA, and then degrade the RNA actually. Okay, so you have apparently opposing effects of these two proteins, and probably is the relative ratio of the two proteins expressed in the cell that will determine if methylation will increase translation or increase degradation of RNA. Okay. So apparently there are not that many studies today on this methylation. So take this subject as in progress. Okay, so people are trying to understand what it means. But apparently what we know today is that all steps of RNA metabolism were found to be accelerated by this methylation. And as a general effect, it appears that the lifetime of any messenger RNA is just accelerated, and as a result, you have a sharper peak. Okay, so the synthesis is, the processing is increased. Okay, so you reach the maximum earlier than without methylation, and degradation is also accelerated. So actually, you have a sharper peak of activity of the messenger RNA. This is kind of temporary conclusion of what we know today about RNA methylation in that position. Okay, there is an example that is quite interesting. That is in, as you can say, in ES cells. This is has been worked out in using mouse embryonic stem cells. Okay, that you know that they can be treated with factors to induce differentiation, of course. And during differentiation, as you know, the key pluripotency factor, this is SOX2, KLF4, POU5, they actually must be cleared because they are transcription factors that maintain the pluripotency. So if you differentiate the cells, those factors should be eliminated from the cells, okay? So look at this. What the people, this guy made was to make a double knockout of the in ES cells. So they eliminated this enzyme. If you remember, this is one probably the primary enzyme that puts methylation on RNA. Okay. So if you make a double knockout, there is no methylation activity in the cell. Okay. And as you can see, the differentiation is very inefficient in methyl-3-minus-minus mouse, okay, as compared to the normal wild-type mouse in which you have differentiation very, very soon. Okay, so apparently this story of the sharpening of the half-life is probably true, at least in the ES cells. Okay, if anybody of you is interested in the story of methylation and modification of RNA, there's a very nice review here you can take from Nature Reviews. Okay, so we go a little bit farther, and finally we try to move the RNA from nucleus to the cytoplasm. Finally, as you know, not all the RNA actually go to the cytoplasm. Messenger RNAs, of course, yes, because they have to be translated in the cytoplasm, and many other species of RNA should be transferred to the cytoplasm, but not all of them. There are many RNA which have a function in nucleus. Do you remember one of those? Of course you do. Do you remember RNA, which function in the nucleus? Sorry? I cannot hear you. The small RNA, yeah, which make part of the SNRP, for example. Okay. There are so many other. Actually, I don't know what exactly you've seen with Valentina Perisi, but studying transcriptome, I saw that you had many slides showing the function of long non-coding RNAs, okay? And these long non-coding RNAs, 80% of them, they actually are limited to the nucleus. They stay there, and they function in the nucleus, okay? So, but, of course, the RNA, the messenger RNA, they have to move it to the cytoplasm. And as I told you last time, there is a complex of proteins that accompany the messenger RNA through the nuclear pores to the cytoplasm. And if you remember, the major complex is this one, exon junction complex, that marks the place in which introns were placed before splicing. Okay, so the story is that, of course, you have specific transporters. Okay, so you have here in this figure, you see five different kinds of RNA that should be moved to the cytoplasm. For example, transfer RNA, microRNA, small nuclear RNA, and you say, why they have to be moved? Because some of them, they have to be moved to the cytoplasm and then carry back to the, because they have to charge the proteins over them, and then they are transported back to the nucleus. And this is messenger RNA, and this is ribosomal RNA. Okay, so the story is that each of them have special export adapters, so they are bound to special export adapters that are the blue proteins that you see here, okay? And they have export receptors that are in yellow, so this is export receptors, okay? And so each export receptor is specific to a kind of RNA, okay? And they are called exportins. So you have five kind of exportins dedicated to each kind of RNA, okay? And this is an important notion because, of course, there is a limited amount of each type of exportins, okay? So the different molecules that have to be moved to the cytoplasm, they compete to each other, okay? For example, the microRNA that we will discuss next time, they have only one exportin capable of translocating them to the cytoplasm, that is exportin 5. And this is expressed usually in the cells in quite low amount. Okay? So for example, if you induce expression artificially in the lab, you induce expression of a particular microRNA by transfecting cells with a vector that encodes a microRNA, this will saturate exportin 5, and all the other species of microRNA will not be transported to the cytoplasm. So that's the kind of attention that we have to pay every time we make an experiment of this kind. Okay, so when the RNA is in the cytoplasm, we have actually already discussed this fact. The RNA in the cytoplasm go to different phases. Okay, it can be localized to different cell locations. Okay, so there are specific transporters, proteins which bind to the RNA and then carry the RNA in some of the functional places in the cells. Or they can be, of course, remodeled. I mean, the RNA binding proteins that are bound to the RNA are remodeled in part. Okay, so you have cytoplasmatic proteins replacing the nuclear ones, and many proteins are recycled to the nucleus. Okay, and then you have two phenomena of quality control of the RNA, just to check if the RNA is okay. And you remember that in the nucleus we have the intron retaining decay. That means that whenever the intron is left to the RNA, it is destroyed. Okay, and then you have different cytoplasmatic quality control. We will discuss briefly in a few minutes. Okay, and then the problem is this. This is a mechanical and general check, but the problem is that we have probably a regulatory role for this RNA quality control. Okay, this is the primary mechanism of quality control that is called NMD. NMD stands for nonsense mediated decay, and is active for very many different occasions. You can have either a splicing junction that is not correctly spliced, let's say. Okay, so we discussed it already one time that the splicing should be very precise, otherwise it will bring the sequence out of frame. Okay, so whenever you have either an error of transcription, or for example a mutation, okay, or whatever else, in which the splicing, or also an intron if you want, okay, but different situation, in which you have a shift of the frame, okay, so think about how frequent just random can be a stop codon. Just make this kind of calculation. You remember how many stop codons are in the code?
Three.
Okay. So how many codons can overall?
3 and 4.
4 to 3. Okay. That makes 4 to 3. How many?
64.
So we have 64 codons. Okay, one is the initiation codon, that is a UG, okay. 60 are coding amino acids, and 3 are stop codons. So now calculate, please, the frequency that you can find in a random sequence. You have a random sequence of RNA or whatever. What is the frequency of finding a stop codon? By chance, I mean.
Three?
That makes more or less 1 out of 21. Is correct? 3/64 makes around 1 out of 21, and dot something. Okay? Is that correct?
I guess.
Yeah, your guess. What about the others? Do you agree? Yeah. Okay. This means that every 20 random nucleotides in a sequence, you may find a stop codon by chance. Is that correct in your mind? Okay. So what is the main feature of an ORF? What we call open reading frame. Is a sequence
without
stop codon. That's the goal. Whenever you change the frame, a stop codon will appear very shortly, very immediately, more or less, because by chance you find it. Okay? So, this long story to say you that every kind of event, error in transcription, error in splicing, mutations, because sometimes you have mutation also, okay? You will get a premature stop codon. Okay? In the sequence, you will have a pre-termination codon, premature termination codon. In this slide, the others call them PTC, standing for pre-termination codon. Okay. So if you have a pre-termination codon, what happens to the splicing junctions? unless this premature stop codon is the very last test, you will have still the okay, you have termination complex here. This is normal termination codon, okay? And you have a premature termination codon here, correct? Okay. So if you think about the splicing events, okay, we go to the next story, okay? You will have something like a exon-exon junction before the termination codon, right? Because this is the last exon and this is the three last exons, okay? But if any kind of pre-termination codon occurs, it will be earlier than the exon-exon, the last exon-exon junction, okay? So in the doesn't work anymore. Okay, so during translation, okay, this is translation. The ribosome will encounter EJC, so exon junction complex still bound there. Okay, usually this is removed. Okay, it's removed. I mean, when you have several exon junction complex bound in the RNA, and when the ribosome passes through, it will remove this exon junction complex. But if you have a PTC, you have a premature termination codon, of course, the ribosome will stop here. In that case, the exon junction complex will stand on the RNA. So there is a mechanism of degradation of the RNA that is dependent on the EJ complex that still can bind to the RNA. Okay. So whenever you have one or more, of course, exon junction complex protein still bound to the RNA, this RNA will be degraded. Okay, and this is the control system, which is called NMD. Okay. Actually, it works also in another occasion. So when you have a very long 3' UTR. If you have excessively long 3' UTR, the mechanism works also. We don't know how exactly, but this works. So this is because probably the transcription didn't stop. Okay, so you didn't have the correct polyadenylation, so the RNA polymerase goes very far away, and you have a very long UTR. Okay, so coming back to the story, this is the main mechanism. You have also two other mechanisms. One is called non-stop decay, in which you lose, for any occasion, you lose the termination codon, so the ribosome go through, okay? And in this case also you have a degradation mechanism. And this is the NG, that it means no-go decay, which is whenever you have a stop codon also, or for example a loop, so unresolved loop of the RNA, the RNA polymerase cannot go through, and also in this case the RNA is eliminated. Where this kind of control, quality control happens, mainly in the cytoplasm. And there were some work that showed that actually the ribosome makes a kind of first tour on the RNA. As soon as the RNA is exported to the cytoplasm, the ribosome tries to translate, and if, of course, there is any kind of this situation, the RNA is eliminated. Okay. But actually, exists also some ribosome in the nucleus. This is a kind of this very discussed story. And so you may have also some kind of this quality control in the nucleus. But just take it as a very discussed subject. Okay. So, whatever the effect, the funny story is that sometimes, and not so occasionally, so you have a good number of genes in which you have alternative exon. You see the scheme here. This is a gene. This is a normal splicing for constitutive exons, and then you see, sometimes you see exon in which there is a stop codon inside, okay? And there are quite many, something like, if I remember well, something like 15% of alternative exons are this kind. So when the splicing apparatus will include this exon in the transcript, you have a premature stop codon, okay? That's the story. And so as soon as this mRNA is getting the cytoplasm, the ribosome will try to translate, and the NMD mechanism will eliminate the RNA because there is this premature stop codon. So it appears that this kind of splicing can be an extra system to reduce the translation of a gene, okay? It's a kind of strange story, but actually it works. Okay? So the story is you can have some alternative exon that function as a negative regulator by NMD. Good. So now finally we have this RNA that is in the cytoplasm, and if this is a messenger RNA, it will be translated, of course. Okay, and the story now is how long will this messenger live in the cytoplasm? So what is this instability? And is this shorter or longer life intrinsic to the messenger RNA, or are there mechanisms regulating the stability of RNA in the cytoplasm and so on? So this is an important, very important level of regulation. I told you already, so we always think about transcription, but there exist many, many other levels of regulation. And so the first question is, how can we measure the half-life of RNA? There are many, many kind of tricks, okay? And this is just the graph of decay of RNA, of course, and we define, as you imagine, we define the half-life of the time at which you still have 50% of the original amount of RNA, okay? So there exist essentially two kind of methods to measure the half-life. One is blocking the RNA polymerase. You block the RNA polymerase activity in the cell, okay? So what is left, and then you follow in the time how much of the RNA is left, okay? So you make experimental points measure and then try to draw a line, okay? That's the first story. This has been used for several years, for several decades, let's say, okay? One problem is, do you think that the cell will resist several hours without transcription? Of course not, okay? This is a very toxic kind of approach to the problem. Usually you can go to, let's say, 4 hours, 5 hours, not more than that, otherwise the cell will die. And also you have a so high toxic effect that you cannot interpret the result as a physiological, okay, as a physiological measure, of course. And the second story is to label nascent RNA. So you try any kind of tricks to incorporate in the nascent RNA a label. A label means a different nucleotide or a chemical modification that you can measure in some way. So you make a pulse of labeling, okay, and then you release the pulse, okay, and then follow the modified RNA life. Okay, so in that case, you don't block the RNA polymerase, the cell will stay alive, no problem, and you go through. Okay, The problem here is that whenever you incorporate a different nucleotide as compared to the normal one, it may be that the RNA polymerase doesn't like it that much. Okay, so if you, for example, the first thing that you can think about is to put, for example, biotinylated nucleotides. Very easy story. We make that story in the lab in vitro very often to label RNA. Okay, but in vitro, when you give biotinylated nucleotides to the cell is not that happy, and the speed to which the RNA polymerase makes the RNA is slower, because this is a different nucleotide, it's larger, it has modifications, so the affinity is different, so on and so on. So you have problems, okay, on that kind. We will see how to resolve them. So let's see the older measure. This is an older measure, classical measure. If you look in the papers in between 1980 and 2000, you find lots of papers like this one. So you treat the cells with actinomycin D. This is the molecule. This actinomycin D blocks the RNA polymerase. Okay. And then you take the RNA at different time intervals from cells. Okay. And you make a measure. Usually, to measure this kind of story, you can use, for example, this kind of assay. Have you ever heard about this assay, RPA, RNA protection assay? Have you already heard about? Probably not. Please say. No. Okay. So very simply, you have RNA to measure. Okay, you make a probe, a small probe. That is a complementary DNA or RNA, okay? And you mix, you label with radioactive, and you mix with the cell extract. It will bind to the RNA, and then you use a single-strand specific exonuclease. So all the RNA is digested except the part that is protected by your probe, okay? And then you run everything on a gel, and you see bends like this one, okay? So when you make, for example, this is no, in the first five lanes, you see the effect with no active actinomycin D is added, so normal situation. In the normal situation, you see a steady state level because the transcription compensates for the elimination, okay? So you have the same level of RNA, and as you can see, the bands are equivalent in all the time points. But when you block the actinomycin D, of course, the transcription is not active. You just see the decay of the RNA and disappears in the time. Okay. Then you quantify the band, you calculate, you make the points as before, and you trace the curve, and you can calculate the life. And this has been used for many, many genes in many, many different papers, but it's an old method. Okay. I can't change it anymore. Okay. So, of course, our interest today is to go to genome-wide analysis, okay, to measure the half-life or the stability of all the RNA at the time. And there are, fundamentally, there are three kinds of methods, A, B, and C. This is very complicated, so what I did was to separate the figure in parts to be able to see. This is transcription arrest, so is that exactly what I told you before about actinomycin. So you can use actinomycin. Then in the ears, scientists discovered different and less toxic molecules to block the polymerase. One is called a DRB. That is the short name for this dichlororibofuranosylbenzimidazole or alpha amanitin. Okay, you can use either of those. Okay, so you have cells, you will add the blocker and then recover at different times, and then you can isolate RNA and go to, for example, to microarrays or to RNA-seq as you want, the same. Okay. and then calculate your alpha for each of the RNA species in the cell. Okay, so that's the kind of quite used approach in the early 2K. Then the second one is make a pulse and chase. Pulse and chase is exactly what I was telling you before. So you make a short pulse with a modified nucleotide. Usually we use UTP just because it's the easiest one to chemically modify. And for a while you pulse like 1 hour or less, whatever. Okay, and then you chase, means that you change again the medium with normal nucleotides and go for several time points. Okay, and then again you can isolate the label RNA, for example, and look with microarrays or NGS as you want again. But the key story is that you isolate the labeled, so the modified RNA in this case. Okay. So the story. The story is this one. So you make, for example, one of the molecules that people use is this 4SU, that it means 4-thiouridine. So you have a S atom in place of an oxygen in the fourth position of the uridine. If you remember how the uridine is, more or less, you remember? It's a pyrimidine and oxygen on 4, oxygen on 2. Okay? So one of the oxygen is substituted with thio, so with S. And this makes a special reactivity. So whenever you this is a very small modification. So the polymerase doesn't actually sense it, and it incorporates the thiouridine as it was normal uridine. Okay, so no change in transcription. And when you have this thiouridine label RNA, it's quite easy to biotinylate after that. Okay, so you take the cells, you extract the RNA, and then you make a chemical reaction that is specific for the thio. Okay, so you will attach a biotin over there, and this is quite easy to do. And then using streptavidin, you can isolate only the pulsed RNA in that period. And after that you can isolate and then sequence or whatever. Okay? So these are the methods that I use it today to make analysis of the RNA half-life. Okay, and then there is another method that is an indirect method, in the sense that of course the degradation rate of RNA can also be calculated by ratio in between the steady state level and the transcription level. Of course, the steady state level is the result of transcription and elimination. If you have two of these parameters, you can calculate the other one. Okay? So what you can do is to make run-on. You remember genomic run-on? I know that Valentina Perisi has explained you. This is called GROW-seq. You remember GROW-seq? GROW stands for Global Run-on Sequencing. And run-on, if you remember, evaluates directly the rate of synthesis, so transcription of the RNA. So you can run genomic run-on and then make total RNA and nascent labeled RNA. And then you make the ratio in between the two and you have the half-life estimation for each of them. Okay? So this is the third method that people is using for this half-life determination. Okay, so now this is methods, but let's take a look of some result, of course, what happens. And this is the first paper appeared in 2003, so it makes 15 years ago. But I choose it because this James Darnell is one of the most prominent scientists in cell biology. Some of you probably remember this name because there is a famous book of molecular cell biology, Lodish and Darnell. You remember? No? Maybe. Okay. So anyway, no problem. And actually, the authors of this paper in New York were all of them had very big success in their career in science. Mihaela Zavolan is now in Switzerland. She's in Zurich. No, sorry, in Basel. And she's a bioinformatician, and actually we know very well because she makes part of the faculty of our PhD school. This is Nikolaus Rajewski, actually is the people who discovered the circular RNA. You remember, we discussed it last time. And Mark Schroeder is now in Germany, making RNA story about synthesis of RNA and so, and Jens Danner is almost Nobel Prize, we don't know, almost. Okay, anyway, so what they did was they take these FG2 cells that are human liver carcinoma cell lines, and they also took primary cells that are fibroblast bud 8. Primary, okay, so not established cells. And they made actinomycin treatment for 2-3 hours. That is probably the vital limit for treatment. Then they made the RNA extraction, labeling, and they went to the affymetrix macroarrays. Okay, so these were the very first version in 2002, the very first version of affymetrix arrays interrogating something like 6,000 to 7,000 genes in the mouse and up to 10,000 genes in human. So they could estimate the K rate for more or less 5,000 genes. And what they found is that the median half-life in both cell types is around 10 hours. They could estimate this one. But the range is very wide. Some of the RNA have a short half-life, something like half an hour, okay? And some other, they have days as a stability. Okay, so but this is very interesting because it was the first estimation genome-wide of the inhuman cells, because people had already this kind of glimpse in Escherichia coli, in Saccharomyces, and whatever, but not in human. This is the first time. So okay, and let's take a look of another study that was published several years after, in 2010, but just because there are some pictures interesting. So I didn't choose it because it's particularly important in biology, just because it has some consideration for our course. In this case, they look at the mouse myoblasts, and again, actinomycin D, and samples collected at from 0 to 230 meters, the next more or less 4 hours, again, short time. And again, total RNA level, then hybridized to affymetrix mouse gene 1 arrays. That was the array available at that time. And this is one of the results, just to show you how different it is. They made a triplicate analysis, so each line is one of the triplicate measurements. And as you can see, this is one of the very stable RNA. This is GDPD3, you see, a gene, and the half-life is 444 minutes. That makes, well, it's good in mathematics, please. Seven hours? Okay, more or less, this is half-life, and this is very quick on the other side. This is a transcription factor, FBX05, okay? And you see that this goes away very, very quickly, and in 33 minutes you lose half of that, okay? just to say the difference. Okay, so if you look at the totality of the mRNA that they could evaluate, okay, you see here the distribution. So this is half-life in hours, and this is the gene density. So you can see that the highest class here is about 2 and something, okay? 2 to 3 hours, you have most of the RNA over there. Then you have a tail of very quick RNA that disappear very quick, and then you have few of them that are lasting for several hours. Okay, so this story. Okay, this is just an example. There are many other studies on different cell types and so on. More or less the results are there. So you have an idea of what is the half-life of our RNA in human cells or mouse cells or whatever. So the next question that you can ask is that why do quick RNA exist and long RNA exist? I mean, you have stable and unstable RNA. Is there any kind of logic in being a suicide RNA or a very long stable RNA? Okay. And so what you can do is to make a gene ontology analysis. Okay, so you can take, for example, all the first portion here, very quick RNA, okay, and examine what they encode for, and then look for the very, very long-lasting RNA and look for what they encode for. Okay. So this is the result, for example, for the first study that we saw, this young study of in 2003. And this is the rate of decay. Okay, so rate of decay is the contrary of the life that you saw before. So don't be confused, it is the other way around. This is the rate of elimination of the RNA. So in the very stable RNA are there, okay, and the very unstable are in the other side. And this is the proportion of probes, so it means the proportion of genes. Okay, and in this graph, they show you the black ones that are all, okay, so all, okay, and the two lines just are the confidence line, 98% confidence line. Whenever you have a statistical distribution, you have confidence intervals, right? Can you follow me? Yeah. So the two lines are the two lines that include 98% of events. Okay. Okay. This black line is all RNA. Okay. So this is the average of everything. Okay. When you take only the gene ontology process transcription, so you will include in transcription all the transcription factors, all coactivators, corepressor, and blah blah that you know. Okay, the distribution is the red one. You see there. Again, this is the limit of confidence. Okay, and so this means that the majority of transcription factor have a very rapid decay. Okay, so the majority of proteins that RNA that encoding for transcription factors or whatever has something to do with transcription, they have very short half life. Okay, they are eliminated from the cells quite quickly. Okay. And the green lines on the other side are biosynthesis. The GO term is biosynthesis, which includes all the enzymes making normal metabolic reactions. So, glycolytic enzymes, Krebs enzymes, phosphate pentose pathway enzymes, and blah blah. Okay? So they are, as you can see, the two green lines fall very quickly. That means that the average decay rate is low, so they have stable RNA. Okay, does this result make sense in your opinion? What do you think? Please, express yourself. What do you think? Yes, why? Exactly. So metabolic enzymes usually are stable as a level because cell, in any case, needs glycolysis and Krebs and whatever in a very steady state level, more or less. So, okay, occasionally you may have some special need, but not in general. Okay. On the contrary, transcription factors are regulating. Most of them, they are regulatory, so they respond to cell events, okay, and they have to mediate very quick responses and not to be lasting for long times. On average, of course, there are also transcription factors that are actually constitutively expressed in cells, of course, but the majority of them are quick, okay, so that's the reason why. Good. So the question is, okay, the half-life are correlated to the function of the encoded proteins. And the second question, then I can probably stop for a minute, but the second question was if a RNA is unstable or is very stable, are there sequence elements in the RNA that will determine the result, okay? So like elements in the sequence. Okay, we can examine that one also. So the story is to search for regulatory elements, okay? And there are many, you study this kind of part in bioinformatics, so I don't want to steal the job to my colleague, of course, but just to say, you can. There are different algorithms, you can explore sequences to find elements in the sequence that are repeated. And for example, Young, in the first paper, they used algorithms that were available at that time, just to show you the result, okay? So what they did, just really as an example of what the bioinformatician can do with this kind of result. So what they did was to divide, first of all, to divide the messenger RNA in four parts, okay? Actually in three parts, that is five prime UTR, the ORF, and the 3' UTR, okay? Or the whole sequence, I mean, everything together. Then they look at for described motifs. So this is a kind of algorithm in which you know already the sequence and you look inside your RNA to find if they are present or not, okay? More present or less present, okay? So these are motifs that people already described as regulatory motifs in the RNA. Okay, don't be surprised on T because it's referred to the gene. Okay, so you see that all these motifs, they found some significant, this is the P value, okay, of the presence of this motif in the RNA, and they found this motif in unstable RNA, unstable, okay, so those who are degraded very quickly in the ORF. Okay, this is 2 in A minus 12, so this is very significant. And they found also this motif here in the ORF and the UTR, and this motif in the UTR, okay? And this motif in the ORF. So they found common motifs that are already known to be destabilizing motifs. And then you can use another algorithm to find for undescribed motifs. This is a kind of, maybe that Professor Cordero will explain you how to do it. This is a kind of searching for any kind of word, say sequence, that is overrepresented in a set of sequences. It's like taking a book, okay, and calculating the page in each page, which is the word that is more frequent, something like this one. Okay, not really very intelligent as a system, just looking for the frequency. And what they found was that, again, there are many motifs that are enriched in either 5' UTR in this case, ORF in this case, UTR in this case. Okay, so actually the answer is, this is just, forget this table, but just to, as an example to say you, yes, the short-living RNA, they have motifs inside that we can see, okay? The same story for the long-living, okay? So, to make the story short, you have intrinsic, okay? So you have elements of the sequence that is intrinsically saying, I am a short-living RNA, I am a long-living RNA, okay? Can we stop for 5 minutes? You don't agree? I agree. Okay. So, at this point, let me just examine quickly what are the pathway to degradation, because it's quite important for the next subject. Okay, this is actually a subject that is in molecular biology 1, so usually, so I go quite quick. It's not regulatory, it's just to remember you. Okay, so whenever you have RNA, you have 3 kinds of activities that you can have to degrade it, okay, to decay. The first is to have a 5' to 3' exonuclease. Of course, they are not active when the RNA is capped, okay? So it has to be decapped before the exonuclease starts eating it, okay? And then you have 3' to 5' exonuclease as well, okay? And again, if you have a polydenylation there, it will protect it from the degradation. And third, last but not least, as you can see in a minute, endonuclease. Endonuclease are, of course, enzymes that are more or less specific that can cut the RNA wherever in the sequence. And of course, they will produce a 3' N that will be exonuclease degraded, and a 5' N here that would be degraded as well, okay? Because no cap, no poly A, okay? So whenever you have a cut inside, you will have all the activities going on very quickly, okay? So it's a normal RNA like this one, okay? You have this protection here, okay? And this protection here. So the first event is to eliminate capping, okay? Or eliminate, what is that? Or eliminate the poly A, okay? This actually is, there is a specific poly A nuclease that is quite slow. So usually the normal polyadenylated RNA, they get slowly shortened and shortened and shortened until it reaches to A10, so 10 residues of adenine. At this point, actually, the 3' exo will start working, okay? So in this direction here, you have the decapping protein, that is a specific enzyme that will decap the RNA, starting degradation from 5'. And at this point, you have the XRN1 enzyme that is the more active, the most active enzyme in 5' to 3' in mammalian cells, okay? And on the other side, you see, this is the protein that will bind to the A when it's shorter than 10 residues, okay? And the degradation from 3' to 5' is by the exosome. Exosome is a complex of proteins, okay, which have this kind of very quick, very rapid 3' to 5' degradation activity. So this is the way, okay? Okay, this is just to say that degradation and translation are competing events, because if you remember, this is our RNA, okay? This is the cap, and this is the poly A. And as probably you remember, the protein which bind to the poly A and the protein which bind to the CAP, that is the 4E initiation complex, okay, they stay together, okay, for ribosome initiation, okay. So this is the situation in which you can have ribosome initiation. So when the translation is active for a messenger RNA, actually the ends of the RNA are protected, and so the stability of the RNA will increase. Okay, so translation, in other words, translation will protect from degradation. If you have the translation blocked, okay, these ends will be free, okay, and so they start to degrade quickly. So degradation and translation actually compete each other. Okay, then you have this sequence inside, okay, and what we saw is that we have sequences inside that can work as destabilizing or stabilizing elements, okay? The ones that we were talking about before that are more frequent or less frequent in the RNA, okay? And so how they work? Actually, whenever you have this destabilizing event, there is a protein binding to it in the RNA that is recruiting the degradation enzymes, okay? Poly A is a nuclease, the capping enzyme and whatever, okay? And wherever you have a stabilizing enzyme, the binding of another RNA binding protein, okay, will avoid the binding of the stabilizing protein and actually increase the stability of poly A binding protein, protecting the poly A tail, okay? So these elements actually work through proteins, reading the sequence, which interacts with the normal apparatuses of stabilization or destabilization. Okay, so these motifs that you see here so these elements that you see here and these proteins are two classes actually. You have pure proteins. Okay, so proteins that are only made of proteins that can stabilize or destabilize. Or you can have, probably I have to change my battery because it doesn't work much. Or regulatory RNA. And if I say regulatory RNA, of course, you remember immediately microRNA, siRNA, and whatsoever. So two classes, one is pure proteins, the other one is protein plus RNA that will direct the protein to the target, okay? Let's have a look to the most common protein regulator, that is the RA protein. Okay, these RA elements are named after AU-rich element. So RA means AU, rich regulatory elements. Okay, they are usually found in the 3' UTR of messenger RNA. Actually, if you remember, are the same elements that we have found in the Darnell's paper before. And here you have just examples of proteins whose RNA are very quick, very, very short-living. This is a transcription factor, FOSMIC. You see, June and others, interferon A, all proteins that have to be expressed and released very quickly. And as if you look in the 3' UTR of this messenger RNA, you always find this AUUUA sequence, either alone or repeated several times, as in this case. And this sequence is bound by these RA binding proteins, okay? They bind to the sequence and recruit degradation enzymes, okay? Sometimes, very, very rarely, there are reports of the other way around, so that the binding of RA binding protein will stabilize an RNA. But in all these cases, they are not the classical isoform of the protein. They are different isoforms that are expressed only in very special cases. So just please look at this left side of the slide. Other proteins that have destabilizing or stabilizing effects in the known. This is a table taken from this review, Gamow et al. Published last year. And as you can see, we have these proteins. This is a AUF1, is actually a HNRNP class D. And this is destabilizing. It has a RRM binding domain, and this is the mode of working that can also be regulated by phosphorylation and other stories. Okay, this is a CUG binding protein. CUG means CUG, the sequence. Okay, this is destabilizing, again the same motif, and this is the way it works, and so on. For example, for the neurobiologist in the class, this ELAB protein, very important for neurobiologists because they are mostly expressed in neurons. They are, the main examples are UR and UD. They are stabilizing protein, okay? And they have the same domain, RRM domain. And actually, they compete for with the stabilizing proteins, okay? And interestingly, they have two other functions other than stabilizing the message. They have an increasing rate of translation when they are bound, and especially RNA localization. This is the reason why I told you for the neurobiologist, because ELAB proteins are known to be the proteins that accompany the RNA in the cell prolongation, like neurites or dendrites or whatever. Okay, so they stabilize, of course, because otherwise they get degraded in the travel. Okay, but they accompany the RNA localization. Okay, then other proteins here. I don't make an example, but just to notice that usually each of these proteins have also another function. You seen? This guy, for example, KSRP, splicing. So they work in stabilization, the cytoplasm, but they also work in the nucleus for a different function. Okay. So, making the story short, the other class of regulatory elements is linked to the microRNA. Okay. This is a very important chapter for the regulatory biology, okay, and as you probably remember, microRNA will guide AGO proteins. AGO stands for argonaut, you remember, okay? So we will discuss this microRNA in the next lesson, and the last one for me, okay? But as you know, microRNA work in the RNA interference pathway, so we have to go through quite quickly through, just to remember you, or for those who are not that strong in RNA interference, just to remember you the steps, because it's quite important to remember. So let me take a look of the RNA interference pathway now. Okay. So this interference pathway was discovered several years ago by these two guys, Craig Mello and Andrew Fire. They actually got also a Nobel Prize for that. And this is the original paper in which they described the story. And it was a paper, as you can see, in 1998, so 20 years ago. Okay? February, so good. Is actually, it was a kind of serendipity, because they were working at that time. One of the most used way to knock down the expression of a gene, to study the effect of knocking down, was to use antisense oligonucleotide. So they used small pieces of DNA that were fabricated as a complementary to RNA or something, okay? Because in the cells, there is a special RNA, that is RNase 3, that actually take care of the duplex. Whenever you have a RNA and then something attached to it, it will degrade it. Okay, so it's a kind of common story. It was not really very efficient, I remember. Personally remember some very bad experience with this antisense oligos. But anyway, it was working sometimes. Okay, so they were transfecting cells with this kind of DNA and also RNA. And what happened that is they actually were working with RNA oligonucleotides, not with the DNA oligonucleotides, just because it is more efficient. Okay, so if you make a antisense RNA, is more efficient than the DNA. Okay, so they were transfecting this Senorhabditis elegans with antisense RNA, and as a control. You know that every time you make an experiment, you have also to make a control experiment to be sure that what you see is not due to the manipulation itself. Okay, so they were making the same sequence in sense. Okay, so they transfected it with antisense RNA and with the same small sequence but in sense. And to the big surprise, they had silencing effect with both of them. So they have silencing of the target gene, let's say target RNA, with the antisense and with the sense control sequence. And they try to think about what happens. And so they discovered this RNA interference story. Actually, this wouldn't happen in mammals. If they use it, human cells, they wouldn't have this kind of effect. But they use it, Senorhabditis elegans. And actually, in yeast and in worms, and then stops. In vertebrates, that doesn't happen. Okay. There is a special activity that is RDR, that stands for RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So RNA polymerase that is dependent on RNA, and is actually able to copy any kind of RNA sequence you put in the cell. Okay, so when they put this sequence here in the cell, actually this RDR activity was able to duplicate and replicate it, making the sense in the antisense filament. Okay, so they have this kind of response, and then they started to work to understand this kind of effect, and then isolated the Dicer enzyme, which is the responsible of making short interfering RNA, and then all the story was worked out. They made several publications in those years, and the story now is this one, as you know. So whenever you have a double-strand RNA in a cell, that can derive either from viral replication or from a microRNA, or from something that we introduce experimentally. You know that today is the easiest way to get a knockdown of any kind of RNA is just to transfect siRNA. So we also because they are quite cheap. I mean, siRNA, you can have the synthesis of whatever is the sequence you like for few euros, so it's very convenient. You just transfect the cells with the siRNA and you get response. Okay, so whenever you have double-strand RNA in a cell, you have this Dicer enzyme. It's not written in this slide, but it was in the other one. Okay, but actually it cuts the RNA in small pieces. Okay, producing siRNA, so small interfering RNA. This RNA is, at this point, is incorporated in a complex, which is called RISC, okay, in which one component is this AGO protein, argonaut, that is the protein which directly binds to one of the RNA there, okay. Also, when it comes from the microRNA, it's the same. Okay, and then at this point, this RISC will direct the hybridization of this RNA against any kind of RNA which has the complementary sequence here. Okay, and you have two kinds of effect. You can have either degradation of the RNA as a result, or block of translation. Okay. So in some organisms, not yet in human, or at least the reports in human are few and not that confirmed, but in many other organisms, like for example yeast and Senorhabditis and whatever, there is another kind of complex always containing argonaut, argo, okay, that actually directs this kind of pairing on DNA, making a chromatin-mediated effect, so silencing of the transcription of the gene. Okay, again, this is not that sure in mammalian, okay, but has been described in other organisms. Okay, now let's go through. Okay. So this is again the story from genome or from invasive, whatever is the source of the double-stranded RNA. You have Dicer enzyme cutting in piece. Please note that the complete complementary of the RNA is not necessary. You can have pairs like this one that are only partially complementary to each other, okay? And again, the Dicer enzyme will cut them in the same way, okay? So AGO, and the AGO will direct on target, translation, RNA degradation, and don't look at this other arrow for the moment because this is a kind of particular effect that we don't see any time. Okay, which are the enzymes in the proteins in this pathway? Dicer. Dicer is actually an RNase-3 enzyme, as the one before. So whenever you have a double-stranded RNA, we'll cut it. And this has very particular activity because it cleaves in the two sides, leaving the pieces are 21 to 23 nucleotide long, okay, the pieces themselves. But the characteristic, the feature, the special feature is that it leaves two nucleotide overhang. Okay, so the RNA is not cut blunt, just cut in leaving two nucleotides free. Okay. And this other is argonaut. Actually, argonaut AGO is a superfamily. There are several proteins, you see, the peewee clade, the AGO clade, and the a third clade that is present only in worms. These two, actually there are 8 argonaut proteins in Homo sapiens, okay? And these peewee proteins have a very special domain here that is called peewee domain that has a very high affinity for the ends produced by Dicer, okay? And also, in some cases, this peewee has endonucleolytic activity, not in all the proteins, so only in some of them. Okay, so this is the three major classes of the silencing RNA, that microRNAs, siRNA, and peewee-dependent RNA. Okay. The characteristic of this Dicer project is this one I was saying you before. So this is a 3' overall. Okay. These are all the classes of small non-coding RNA that we know. So there are many, many of those. Probably you've seen already the slide in the transcriptomes, and you were discussing the transcriptomes. But what we are talking about is micro mirtrons, peewee RNA, and endosomal. Okay. So this, what is the genesis of this endo siRNA? So how can we get siRNA? Well, there are many cases in which you can have endogenous siRNA. For example, if you have convergent transcription. Imagine that you have a gene here and a gene here. You remember that the polymerase doesn't stop at the poly A sequence, it will continue. You remember that? Okay? So imagine that the genes are very close to each other. The RNA continues here, and this RNA continues there, so you have a part of the two RNA that are complementary. So you generate a double-strand RNA, actually. Okay? So in transposons, you can have, for example, read-through. So the transcription of one transposome goes through another transposome very far away that is oriented in the other sense. So again, you can find a double strand, or you can have bidirectional transcription in some LTR elements, for example. You remember LTR elements? They derive from viruses, and they very often they have LTR on the both sides, and they are promoters, so you can have transcription both sides, okay? Also, you can have genes that are very similar to the ones. For example, a founder gene, I mean a real gene. You remember that most of our genes have also a pseudogene somewhere. A pseudogene is a copy of the gene that has been mutated a little bit. So if this pseudogene gets transcribed, again it makes a sequence that is very similar to the original one. And again you can have pairs of sensing and antisense in this case. Or you can have duplicated inverted copies, for example, as in this case, okay? So you generate a RNA that is actually self-complementary, okay? Oh, this kind of transposon, all this kind of evidence is linked to transposons, okay? So to repetitive elements, okay? And this actually is a problem when the cell is in the very early stage of development, you remember, and the chromatin is not yet completely formed. Okay, so in the very early oocyte, you have spurious transcription of repetitive elements. And in fact, in that particular case, you have, for example, the third case of argonaut protein expressed, the PIWI. And the PIWI are thought today to be expressed only in that particular case to eliminate this kind of spurious transcription, okay? To degrade, to block this kind of repetitive element transcription. Okay, so this is just the story for pRNA, and I don't go through in a stable way. The pRNA were first proposed to ensure germline stability by repressing transposons. This is the take-home message that I wanted to discuss with you. And then, again, looking for the SI risk assembly. So whenever you have this kind of siRNA produced by Dicer, you go to the assembly of this risk complex, in which Diago goes there, and then it directs again the story. Again, in this slide, you see this nematode and yeast pathway to amplificate this siRNA. We don't have human mouse. We don't have this kind of activity. Okay. And this is the reason. Okay, I have to make a short, short parenthesis. This story about nematode and yeast is also the reason why in the common discussion about RNA interference, and especially the discussion on microRNA, people keep today saying that this is an epigenetic phenomenon. This is it's a kind of very old definition, okay? Because epigenetics was actually described in the first half of the last century, talking about all the phenomena that are not strictly linked to the sequence, okay? But today we call that actually regulation. So we don't say, for example, that a transcription factor is an epigenetic factor. We say that it's a regulatory factor, okay? So in the years, something like 70 to 75, The definition of epigenetics changed a little bit, and the people say, okay, this is a kind, epigenetics means a kind of information that is not strictly linked to the sequence of DNA, but it can be inherited during mitosis. Okay, so you have cell division, and the two daughter cells, they have the same kind of information that was in the original cell. So this is the definition of epigenetics. Now, when the microRNA were described, they were studied essentially in these guys here, nematodes and neons. But they have this kind of RDRP, so the RNA is dependent RNA polymerase. So if you put a silencing RNA in nematode cells, they will replicate it. And they will replicate and then transmit to all the cells in the body, also to the germline cells, so that the progeny of that animal will still have this RNA, okay? And again, you make, for example, in the yeast, you have permanence of this sequence for many, many generations. And this has produced our, let's say, not completely correct definition of microRNA as an epigenetic factor. In those organisms, is epigenetic in some sense, because it is transmitted from cell to cell in mitosis and also in generations, okay? So it's a kind of epigenetic factor. But in human cells, you never see transmission mitotically. And we that are in the lab, we know that very, very well, because when you transfect RNA, siRNA in cells, you have a very short expression of this silencing effect. Okay, you have usually something like last for 72 hours, 3 days or something, and then it completely disappears. So it's not a heritable factor, okay? Good, so go back to the story. The other question is, we have two, okay? We have two filaments in the siRNA. The red and the blue. And so the question is, which one is incorporated in the AGO protein to direct the silence? Okay? The blue or the red one? Is there is any kind of selectivity by the AGO protein? Okay? So there is not a complete rule. Okay? In many cases you have both of the filaments are actually used as a guide for the AGO protein. But if this thermodynamic stability is very different from one to the other one, then it will select the one which has the 5' terminus as the less stable base pair end. So imagine, it's not a complicated story, imagine to have, they are long, 21 to 23 nucleotide long. So imagine to have the first section, 5' terminus, to have A and T, only A and T, okay? And then the last section is only G and C. Of course, this 5' end will be less stable from the thermodynamically point of view than the second half. Okay. In that case, you will only use the RNA which has the 5' terminus as the less stably base pair end. Okay. Only that one will be used as a guide, we say guide, and the other filament will be discarded, and we call it passenger. Okay, so the one which is incorporated in the AGO protein is the guide, the other one passenger, and will be eliminated. Okay, how do small interfering RNA exert the silencing effect? So what happens after the binding? And at several stories, okay, I told you that in some organisms it appears that the AGO protein can bind to the RNA in the nucleus when it's getting transcribed. And then this recruits DNA methyltransferases, so modifies the chromatin locally. This is not demonstrated again in human, okay? Or it can go to the other activity here on the right, okay? When you have ago binding, you can have two phases. If the complementarity is complete, so 20, all the nucleotides are complementary to the target, okay? You will have the so-called slicer activity. That means that the target RNA will be cut in the middle. Okay? So the ago binds to the sequence here, the blue one, and it cuts in the middle. You see there? So you generate an uncapped 5' prime and a not polyadenylated 3'. Prime. So in that case, the apparatus degradation will eliminate everything in a minute. Okay? Or if the complementarity is not complete, okay, so only partial, in this case you have a phenomenon that is called a translation inhibition. So the messenger is not eliminated, okay, but is inhibited translation. And since we saw before that translation and degradation are competing, since the messenger is not translated, it will be degraded. Okay, so it's, this is the story. Okay? Good. So this is the story. Okay, this is just another picture that says the same story that I told you before. And you find it in your textbook. This is the textbook that I put for you for the silencing RNA story. Okay, this one. Okay, it's a short review, but it's quite focused, so it's good for that. So we have another 10 minutes left, just to start the story about microRNA, and it's something that we will take again on next Thursday. So the microRNA are, of course, this is the most interesting part from the regulation point of view, because all the other stories that I told you before, siRNA, are either laboratory tools or something that happens only in germ lines. So I mean, it's a kind of partial story. Okay. From the regulatory point of view, the most interesting object, of course, are microRNA, which are a family of small RNA that are transcribed from several locations in genomes. Okay. Next time we will go to this MIR base. There are actually many databases that contain all the information about microRNAs. They are many, many, many. And if you go to the gene code, for example, you see that there are something like 7,000 or something. So there are many, many microRNAs in our genomes. Okay. So for the microRNA story, I put it as a textbook, extremely recent review that has been published by the chief of the Boston University section, the Bioinformatics Institute. And it will be that you will see that it's a very, very nice review, very, very clear also. Okay. So this is the first figure showing you the pathway to production of microRNAs again, and just go through this. You see that this, you have many metazoan microRNA gene. They are transcribed at poly2, the RNA polymerase 2. Okay, and at this point, the structure of the transcript is they can be very long actually, but the feature is that at a certain point there is a self-complementary sequence. You see that? And this self-complementary sequence is something like usually more or less 30 or something nucleotide long. It's not completely complementary. This kind of bulges that you see here means that sometimes you have non-complementary nucleotides, and then you have a loop that can be 10 to 15 nucleotides long over there, and this is called primer. Okay. At this point, there is a microprocessor that is formed by these two proteins here, DGCR8 and DROSHA. And this is the microprocessor in the sense that we take this transcript and cut it there. You see there? Clack, clack, where the arrows are. They will cut and produce a pre-microRNA hairpin. Okay, this is the form which is taken up by the exporting 5 and is transported to the cytoplasm. In the cytoplasm, the dicer enzyme will take this hairpin loop here and cut again. Okay, cut here and here, where the arrows there are, and will produce a phosphorylated strand and the other phosphorylated strand, and as you can see, there are two nucleotides overhung here and here. Okay, so this is called microRNA duplex, and at this point one of the two is eliminated and the other one will be incorporated in ego protein, and this is the silencing complex, the RISC that you saw before. So again, I told you again, so when the complementarity is complete, like in this case, okay, you will have a cut endonuclease activity, okay? And this is typical of only one of the ego proteins in human, that is EGO2. EGO2 has an endonuclease activity. All the other ones, the domain is mutated and has no more endonuclease activity. When the complementarity is partial, as in this case and this case, okay, you have the block of ribosome, so the block of translation, okay, and the block also of the proteins which normally protect the poly A tail. So the results again will be the disappearing of this message, but with different mechanisms. Okay, so look, only pay attention to these stories again, so to the overhang, and as a genesis, so what are these microRNA genes in our genome? Well, we have different kind of situation. We have pure microRNA genes, okay, that are exemplified in the two first row here. And they can be either monocistronic, in the sense that the transcript here, this is the cap and this is the poly A, contains only one microRNA structure. So the DROSHA processor will cut here and here and produce a prime microRNA. Or polycistronic, in the sense that in the same transcript, as you can see, there exists more than one structure that will give rise to the microRNA. This is not something that I tell you just to be too precise, just because, of course, the transcription and the production of these three microRNA will be completely coordinated, of course. So the amount of those three microRNA will be the same, okay? And sometimes you have other situation in which the microRNA is not produced by a dedicated microRNA gene, but comes from other transcript. For example, this is a long non-coding RNA that is called BLC and ncRNA with exons and introns, okay? And from the very last exons, as you can see, there is a microRNA incorporated. So this microRNA is processed out of a transcript of a different story. And sometimes this happens also to encoding RNA. This is another non-coding RNA, but this one here, this is a pre-messenger RNA. So it's a normal coding gene. And as you can see, these are exons. And in this intron here, there are three microRNA structures. So this again is very important to you, because it means that the production of this protein here is coordinated with the production of those microRNA. Okay? So you have the same kind of regulation of the proteins and the microRNA in the introns. Okay? These are called mirtrans, that is a fusion of microRNA and introns. So the people they call mirtrans. Okay? I think this is the last slide. So just to tell you again all the mechanisms of production, it was just to finish some in some way. We will take again on Thursday the story and discuss the all the problem of understanding what are the genes that are regulated by microRNA, how they are regulated, and so on. Okay. So, 11 o'clock, correct. Thank you, and